This is Amy Hall. I'm here with Greg Kokel, and you're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRask podcast. And this
morning,
is the podcast.
Amy.
Good morning, Greg. This is the podcast where we take your questions that you send to us on Twitter with the hashtag STRask. So keep sending those questions, and then we respond to them. Mm-hmm. So we're going to start today with a question from Silence. If our body's cells
are
not...
Is this the sounds of silence?
Silence, S-I-L-E-N-S.
Oh, I see. Okay. Just checking.
If our body's cells are not individual human beings, but have the full chromosomal structure of human organisms, should we justify that zygotes are human beings because of their chromosomal structure? If not, how exactly can we base our definition of human organisms?
Well, strictly speaking, for those who are careful, we are not grounding humanness simply in the DNA. What we are doing is we are recognizing the existence of a whole organism. And this is pretty obvious from a biological perspective. This particular organism is a whole thing. That is, it is its own self and will grow through stages of maturity to express these different levels of development. And let me just, maybe this is going to sound crude a little bit, but to give an illustration, if you have an insect egg, that egg is a whole self. How do we know that? Because if we watch it, it will hatch and a larva will come out. The larva will eat, and given the right environmental conditions, that's all. It will then pupate, and then it will hatch from the pupa and become an adult. Actually, I'm thinking of my monarch chrysalis I have in my little cage here. I captured some monarch caterpillars and fed them milkweed, and this one's about to hatch. So there's the sequence. Now, I use that illustration from insects because they all go through these four stages, and they're very well-defined stages, although it seems pretty obvious that, watch this, the creature that flies away is the same creature that comes out of the egg and eats the plant as a worm, okay, and exists in pupa form. It's the same individual. It's just going through different stages. Now, we don't have stages like an insect, but we do have stages of growth that we give different names to, and those names are zygote, fetus, newborn, infant, baby, child, adolescent, adult, old guy, right? Okay, so those are we just have these terms that we identify broadly, somewhat arbitrary stages, but note that none of those are separate things. That's like people say it's not a human, it's a zygote. And my question is, what kind of zygote is it? Well, it's a human zygote. How do you know it's a human zygote? You look at the DNA. So what the DNA is not the thing that makes it human, an individual human being, because if that were the case, then every cell that has the same DNA would be an individual human being. What makes it, the DNA is what allows us to identify it as a human being because it has a human signature. And it also allows us to identify, for those who are, you know, want to go this direction, as a cell at that stage that is not the mom's body because it has a different DNA fingerprint. It has half her DNA, half dad's DNA. So it has its own constellation of DNA and characteristics that are unique to it. Now, of course, we don't need to know that. It has its own unique thing to know it's not the mother's body, because even though we might be confused momentarily in zygote stage, as that individual thing continues to grow through its stages of development, it becomes obvious it's not mom's body. It could have a different blood type, could have a different sex, etc. It doesn't become a different thing because there's no stage at which it does that. It's simply develops through its the normal developmental stages of any individual human being. Now, this is not philosophy, and this is definitely not religion. This is science. We are just looking at how the things work. And when we see how these things develop, it's very, very clear, and this is standard embryology, that there is a new individual being that comes into existence at the moment of conception. The egg is no longer an egg. The sperm is no longer an individual sperm. The two join together. The egg and the sperm as entities cease to exist, though their stuff is still there, but their stuff is making something else. Okay? So just to give a parallel, I got a tree in our yard that we cut down because it had beetles and it was dying, dangerous. So now I got a bunch of wood here. It was a tree. I take the wood and I take it into my shop and I bandsaw it into planks and I join it down and I dimension it and cut it into pieces. I make a chair out of it. It is no longer a tree. It's a chair. Now, that wood is the same wood that was in the tree that's in the chair, but it is a different entity. Just like the egg and the sperm, the stuff is still there. It's joined to make a new thing and the old thing disappear. Those trees are no longer there. That pile of wood out on the side of my house is not the trees. That pile of, that piece of furniture in my shop is not the tree. It came from the tree. And in the same way, the egg and the sperm are no longer present at conception. The new thing came from the old things, but it is its own new thing. And by the way, you get the general point of the illustration, but we can go further in the case of the embryo, zygote embryo child, is that it also has a nature that is it's a living human thing. It's not just like a dead chair. It's alive with, and it's corporeal, it's physical, and it also has, it's animated by life, and it has an individual essence, I would argue. That is philosophical, but these are all things that make that individual unique from the mother and make it the kind of being that it actually is.
Mm-hmm. And the key, as you said, this is a whole organism. It's self-directed. Everything within it is working towards the growth and development of it as a whole organism. Now, that's very different from a cell on my arm. That cell is working towards the good of me as a whole organism made up of all these cells. But the zygote is its own whole organism. Mm-hmm. So that's the difference between a part of me and a whole thing.
That's right.
Whole
that's
human
right.
being.
Exactly right.
Okay, let's go on to a question from Alice. How would you respond to a man who used the Lewis quote, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exist, to support the idea that his desire to be female is legitimate and that his soul is female and he will be female in heaven?
Oh, that's interesting. I had not heard that application. Okay, that's Lewis's argument from desire. I don't think all that Lewis's argument amounts to is that desires have fulfillments. That's all he's saying at this point. That is the foundational argument. Okay, he is not saying that all desires are good desires and that the fulfillments of those desires are good fulfillments. He's not saying that. It's not his argument. His argument doesn't even entail that. He's just simply saying we have appetites that have fulfillment and they have potentially. Look at we have a sexual appetite. Well, that appetite for some people might be fulfilled in a forcible rape. I guess that's a redundancy. In rape, okay? Does that make, would Lewis argue, well, see, that's the desire being fulfilled. There you have it. No problem. No, he would say it's a problem because it's an illicit fulfillment of that desire. There is an appropriate fulfillment of that desire, and rape is not it. Underlying point is if you have a desire, then there is an appropriate, there is a fulfillment for it. Okay. And, but our desires can be disordered. This is clear, and he argues that in other places. His point simply is if we have a desire for justice and justice isn't done, then there is a place where justice is done, and it's not this life, it's the next. We have a hunger for something that is not satisfied in this life, so we are obviously, he argues, made for another life. Okay, and that's all that he's willing to take it to. He is not willing to say that the desire to be, well, to be female, if you're genetically or physically a male, is a desire to have its proper fulfillment. By the way, I think what Lewis is going to say, and this is all part of the discussion, because there's an assumption that's being made here. The assumption is that the state of mind is reality. Lewis is going to say, for the person who wants to become a female, this is a desire that is not possible to fulfill, because there is no such a thing as a male becoming a female. You can, sex change operations are not possible. What can be done is the body can be looked different, and people can have different feelings by taking, you know, potentially by taking hormones or something like that, but their sex never changes. All it is cosmetics. And I don't mean to say this insensitively. I'm just making the observation. So Lewis is going to say the desire to be a different individual is a disordered desire. Okay? So he's not denying the possibility of disordered desires. He's just simply saying that when it comes to fundamental realities, like the ones he described, those desires have satisfactions.
And I would also point out that he's desiring to be female. Well, femaleness exists. So he is desiring something that exists. It's what he wants to do with that. That's a different thing. He's longing for femaleness, which actually is a thing that exists.
It does exist, but it's not available to a male.
Right, right.
Desire to be a rabbit, if I desire to be a rabbit, it doesn't mean that Coco can become a rabbit, because if Coco became a rabbit, then Coco would no longer be Coco.
And I don't think Lewis, his quote entails that. If we desire something beyond this world, that means that thing exists. It doesn't mean we're going to become God. It doesn't mean we're going to, that's a different thing. But the fact that he exists, our desire for that reflects that. So even in this case, a desire for femaleness reflects the fact that there is such a thing as femaleness.
Right.
And so I don't think it entails becoming female. Yeah. I don't think his quote ever intended to.
And by the way, the longing, this is central to his, this argument based on desire is tied to his, from even when he was a child, this sense of longing that is not satisfied in this life, okay? Actually, one of his first books called Pilgrim's Regress developed this idea. So this has been a huge part of his whole thing. However, he'll be the first to acknowledge, and you see this is a great divorce, not everyone's longing is satisfied. It's not actually satisfied. There is a possibility of satisfaction, rightly ordered, in God. It's not a satisfaction that comes from sex or relationships or money or acquisitions or anything in this life. Those are the things that are people use to try to fill the hole. It is actually a satisfaction that's required by the only thing that is meant to satisfy that, and that is a deep relationship with God, which is denied those who reject him.
And you could also point out to him that perhaps he's misunderstanding his real desire here. His true desire is to be whole. His true desire is to be healed, is to be the person he was created to be. That's his desire. Now, he misunderstands how that's going to be fulfilled. But if he follows God, those things will be fulfilled for him.
Right.
Not in the way he thinks, but ultimately, he will be healed. He will be whole. He will become the person God created him to be if he's following God. Those things will be fulfilled ultimately in the end. Just not the way that he's demanding they be fulfilled.
This is a great point, Amy, and it because it speaks to the falsehood that a person's desires reflect the real individual, and that's the relativistic lie. Reality is inside of us. Okay, if I really believe, I'm going back to the rabbit illustration, and I used to do this 15 years ago as a parody. But, you know, you parody something and, you know, it no longer becomes a parody. It becomes a reality. And there are websites dedicated to people who think they're animals. Okay? They believe they are. There are websites dedicated to people who think they're amputees when they're not. And they want to have a doctor cut their arm or leg off to match their identity. I'm not making this up. I wish I were. Okay, so this shows that there are disordered desires, and the desire that you mentioned is to be whole. But the solution is to make the mind whole to match the body, not to try to match the body to the mind, which, as I said, in a literal sense, cannot happen because there is no such thing as a sex change operation. And even in a psychological sense, it's not successful, not consistently. Some people say they feel better, but you know, the suicide rate is 9 times or maybe 19 times. I get these numbers mixed up. 19 times at least the national average for those who are transsexual. And it has nothing to do with judgmental Christians. That's a baloney. That's a canard. It's because something inside of them is not right. And cutting their body, changing their body is not going to fix that.
They think this is the solution to the way they're feeling about themselves, and it's not. And that's really sad. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe the solution would be to help him to understand what his true desires are and then talk about how we can only find that in God, in Christ, when we're joined to him.
And in God's purposes, because this is the liability. Sometimes we talk about true desires because it focuses on the desires. But what we have to do is, let me put it this way, right desires are tied to right functioning. And right functioning has to do with teleology. What were we made for? We were made for a relationship with God. We were made for a relationship, a man with a woman, you know, male and female, he created them. Okay, I'll provide a suitable helpmate. The two will become one flesh. What God has joined together, let no one tear asunder. So there we have a telos. We have a purpose that God has made. And when we deviate from the purpose, we have trouble. It's just that simple. And so finding what the right order is, that's important. And following your heart is one of the worst pieces of advice you could ever give somebody on this kind of thing. It's terrible.
So let's take one more question from Derek.
All right.
This is kind of an unusual one. I don't think I've had a question about this before. I have a job where I frequently talk to a guy involved in shamanism.
Which is a form of occultic, not exactly witchcraft, but a shamanist, okay.
I've studied your tactics and would like to engage him, but I have no clue how to even get the conversation started. Do you have any experience with this or advice on how to begin?
Well, I don't have experience in shamanism, but the first step of the game plan is always to gather information. It's always the first step, gather information. So in other words, tell me about shamanism. I'm role playing right now, but I'm absolutely new to shamanism. I have a little general idea, but I suspect a lot of my ideas are false about it because they come from movies. So like Gandalf, well, Gandalf is kind of a shaman, all right? It's called a wizard in the movie. I was just watching it last night, which is just timeless. I never get tired of that series. In any event, so Gandalf is kind of a shaman. So are you like Gandalf or different or how so? Okay. Now, what kind of world makes this possible? And how do you know that shamanism is a good, healthy thing to pursue? What do you think about Jesus? And most people, by the way, have a high view of Jesus, okay? Now, remember, Jesus was a Torah-observant Jew. He consistently referred back to the Torah as authoritative on human beings, or particularly Jews, where it comes to the law, but in terms of God, etc. And this kind of shamanism is prohibited there. So this is what a friend we have in Jesus tactic. We're employing Jesus' view and just promote and talk in that sense. I think it's entirely fair to say to somebody that's involved when you get a clear picture, say, you know what, I know you're not going to like to hear this, but this is really dangerous. And it's not true. You have power. That's not a question about that. But the power isn't coming from where you think it's coming from.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. But first of all, I think people love to talk about what they think about these things. So I think we're way more worried about how to start a conversation than we need to be.
Right.
If you go up to this guy and you're asking the questions Greg just mentioned about what is this? What do you do? What is this about? People love to talk about that. There's no need to be nervous about that. I've also found that if you are open and you are and you're not uptight and nervous and angry, you can pretty much say anything. Even what you just said, Greg, where you say, this really concerns me because it seems like ABC. As long as you're not getting upset and agitated, usually they won't either. I've discovered that this is really true. And the other thing I would say is that what I always like to bring the conversation around to, you always talk about this, Greg, where you give the bad news and you give the good news. Mm-hmm. I want to know what they think about their guilt mm-hmm. and what they do with it. What mm-hmm. does shamanism have to say about my guilt? Mm-hmm. How does it deal with that?
Right.
I'm really interested in that because I know that I have sinned and I know I'm guilty and I believe in justice. So it's very important to me that I be reconciled to God. So what is your view say about that, or how do you mm-hmm. deal with that?
Yeah, that's excellent. This is the inside out tactic. I talk about it in the second edition, and it's part of that tactic entails focusing in on the existential need, the thing that people have on the inside that they can't get away from. And it's an excellent application of that, Amy.
And incidentally, I don't know what he would say to that, because a lot of religions that are
occultic.
More occultic or even just, I'm trying to think of how to describe it, but they're not so concerned with morality. They're concerned with other things. They're concerned with doing the right rituals to get the right things, and they're not so much concerned with morality.
Yeah.
So I'd be really interested to hear what he had to say about that. But like you said, Greg, no matter if it's has to do with that or not, as a human being, he knows he's guilty.
That's right.
And so you can still draw that out, but it would be an interesting
that's a great question.
Contrast to see what he says about this.
Yeah, and the shamanism is a type of animistic religion, and animistic religions, they're particularly thoroughgoing in the third world. I live in Thailand for 7 months, and even though the country is officially Buddhist, the heart of the people is with animism, and this is why they are trying to control the spirits. It's all about power. It is not about and manipulation to get what you want. And so you use shamanistic practices or occultic practices if you go to Thailand, you'll find these looks like little birdhouses all around. Every home has got one. But that's an appeasement of the local spirit. They put food out there and stuff like that to manage the spirit. And they give their kids nicknames. So and the Thai names are generally long and complicated and hard to say. But everybody has a nickname like Gop. Gop is a frog, you know. Or nit noi means little or little bit. Yeah, so they have these diminutive names that are given to them. Why do they give them these names like that? Frog. Because they make them unattractive to the spirits. And so when the spirits hear their name and their name is diminutive, then they won't be impressed and they'll leave them alone. So it's kind of silly, really dumb spirits, it seems to me. But the point is that they're trying to manipulate the spirits. And that's what these animistic practices are doing. It's not about morality. It's about power.
I think about this every time I get to the story where Jesus, he sends all the demons out of the man. They go into the pigs. They go into the ocean, to the lake or whatever, yeah, to the water. And
Gennesaret.
Then the people say,
Sea of Galilee.
The people say, you got to get out of here. And at first I didn't understand that at all. But then when I read a story and I can't remember where it was. It might've been in Peace Child or some other book mm-hmm. about a missionary. But their issue was they didn't like Jesus upsetting the spirits. They didn't like Jesus causing trouble because that could cause them trouble. Mm-hmm. So they were more concerned about keeping all the spirits happy so that they wouldn't be bothered by them than they were about the fact that Jesus just commanded them to leave this man out of love for him
right.
and healed him. They didn't even think, oh, I want to have I want to be with Jesus. I want him to be part of my life. Mm-hmm. They actually just were only concerned about the spirits and keeping them all happy. And yeah. So
good point.
I always think about that, and maybe there's some way you can use that story with him as well and see what he thinks about that.
Plus no more bacon and eggs. The herd was gone. The barbecue.
Maybe that was
it.
The real problem they had. Jesus, yeah, where is our bacon? All right. On that note, Greg, thanks so much for answering these questions today. And thank you, everyone, for sending those questions in. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.